Nasir Gami has been challenging psychiatric conventions since the 1990s. He's going to join us today for a conversation on popular myths in psychopharmacology.
Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, brought to you by the Carlette Psychiatry Report, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP student and a dedicated reader of every issue.
I'm here with Dr. Nasir Gami, a professor of psychiatry at Tufts University. This year, Dr. Gami released a textbook on psychopharmacology, weighing in at 600 pages. It's a comprehensive one, but the prose is practical and easy to follow. Dr. Gami doesn't shy away from controversy. His past books have challenged everything from the biopsychosocial model to the use of antidepressants in bipolar disorder. I don't always agree with him, but I always walk away changed by what he writes, and this new textbook is no different. Rather than an encyclopedia of facts, Nasir walks us through the ideas that underlie the way we practice. The book is also full of a lot of surprising facts. We learn, for example, that the atypical antipsychotic risperidone was derived from haloperidol, and that the new antidepressant vilazodone, or Vibrid, shares more in common with trazodone and nafazodone than it does with the new release that it's often lumped with, vortioxetine or Trintellix. Nasir, tell us what we're doing wrong. What are some of the popular myths you see in everyday practice?
Some of the ones that stand out to me are things like the happily ever after fallacy, the idea that what gets you better keeps you better. And sometimes drugs are effective symptomatically, acutely, but they have no long-term benefit because they don't modify the underlying disease.
So I take it you're going to favor drugs that modify the disease and have long-term benefits rather than those that work rapidly and treat acute symptoms.
In general, the general principle I have is that to understand psychopharmacology, you have to make the distinction between symptomatic and disease-modifying drugs. So my general view is that the only psychiatric drugs that are truly disease-modifying are the so-called mood stabilizers, and among them specifically lithium is the strongest and most proven. So lithium, valproate, carbamazepine, maybe lamotrigine would be the ones I would put in that category. They prevent mood episodes, not just in bipolar illness, but also in unipolar depression, at least in the case of lithium. And so they're disease-modifying not just for bipolar illness, but probably for any recurrent mood illness. And that would include a lot of people we're diagnosing these days with so-called major depressive disorder.
Do you see any examples of drugs in other classes that are disease-modifying?
Antidepressants, DARE antidepressants, standard antipsychotics, anxiolytics, amphetamines are all symptomatic drugs that have no long-term disease benefits for any of the relevant conditions, namely unipolar depression, schizophrenia, ADD, or anxiety states.
When you use that term disease-modifying, are you talking about the way that medications affect the underlying biology of the disease, such as neuroprotective agents, or is it more the clinical outcomes that you're looking at?
It's really both. The concept of disease modification in pharmacology is conceived of in two ways. Most commonly, it's conceived of biologically in terms of getting at either the underlying cause of a disease or getting into the pathophysiologic mechanism of the disease. So, for instance, statins are a classic example of getting at pathophysiologic mechanisms, cholesterol-related heart disease. In the case of psychiatry, the only drug that has long-term reduction in morbidity and mortality is lithium. It reduces death by suicide, by medical illnesses, and it reduces hospitalization rates, etc. Maybe to some extent we have some data on some other mood stabilizers to that effect long-term, but that's what would prove disease modification.
So back to this happily ever after fallacy. Another pearl I took away from your book was that apparently antidepressants have better evidence to treat depression acutely than to prevent it with long-term use.
Yes, I think that clearly is what the literature supports the most. One way of looking at it is if you just compare the number of studies we have and then what they found. For acute depressive episodes with standard antidepressants, we have 500 studies of acute efficacy and 15 for prevention. Now, of the acute efficacy studies, about half of them are negative, half are positive. half find efficacy, half don't. So by and large, when you look at that literature, there is acute efficacy, as has been shown in these meta-analyses. It's not a big effect. It's a small effect, as I've emphasized over and over again. And I think we have overinterpreted that literature to mean that they're highly effective. That's not the case. They're mildly effective. But they're not zero. They're mildly effective acutely. And there's some patients in whom they're a little more effective than others.
Now, pause a second, because I'm remembering that a lot of antidepressants are FDA approved for the maintenance phase for long-term prevention. How does that square with what you're saying?
In terms of the maintenance data, those 15 studies, all of them were effective. And the FDA concluded that these are highly effective drugs in prevention. That's not my view, because what we need to understand is that those maintenance prevention trials all have a certain design. It's called a randomized discontinuation design, where everybody has to be treated with their drug and shown to be effective acutely before they can stay into the maintenance phase and then stay on the drug or come off and go on placebo. And essentially what happens is that there's a withdrawal worsening in the placebo group, and that gets interpreted as efficacy of the antidepressant, where it's actually not.
Okay, so it sounds like the antidepressant studies have not done the best job of proving that they have long-term preventative effects. What kind of studies would you need to see to prove that?
What we need to see is that patients get better on the antidepressant without getting withdrawn, just getting randomized to one versus nothing, placebo, without pre-selecting for efficacy to begin with for acute symptoms, and following them for at least a year or longer and showing that you prevent episodes. In fact, almost no studies are designed that way, and very few find any benefit in that direction. So it's not that they're disproven for long-term efficacy. My contention would be they're actually just not proven because we aren't doing the kinds of studies we need to do.
What are some other common fallacies you see in the way we're practicing psychiatry?
Another one is that higher doses produce more benefits. There's always generally a U-shaped curve. Yes, there is such a thing as underdosing, but there is such a thing as overdosing too. Another common one is more is better. You know, more medications, combining medications gives you more efficacy than fewer. That's not true. Once you get into polypharmacy, certainly beyond two medications, we often just don't know what we're doing biologically. Usually when we're using lots of drugs and using them at high doses, it's either because the drugs just are not very effective or we have the wrong diagnosis. One of the general messages of my textbook is that most of our medications are not as effective as we think they are.
In your book, you state that most psychiatric medicines should be given all at once, Q-Day or QHS. Tell us why.
Well, a couple reasons why. From the compliance perspective, as we know, you go from about 90% compliance with a once-a-day dose to 50% twice-a-day in the classic hypertension studies. The other big picture is many clinicians have a mistaken perspective that multiple daily dosing is required to keep stable blood levels. Pharmacologists naturally think this way, but clinicians don't need to follow what the pharmacologists say because stable blood levels are irrelevant for the majority of our patients. They are relevant for some things. So for instance, if you're trying to treat anxiety that's chronic and you're symptomatically controlling it, then yes, if your blood level goes down, your anxiety will come up. But if you're trying to treat and prevent, especially for long-term treatment, mood episodes, depressive episodes, manic episodes, or schizophrenia, none of that matters if your blood level goes up or down for 2 or 3 hours. That's completely irrelevant. The effects of the monoamine agonists, so-called antidepressants, the dopamine blockers, so-called antipsychotics, and the mood stabilizers, so-called mood stabilizers, the effects of those three major classes are, as we know, in the brain, long-term. They involve weeks to months, in fact, months and longer, changes in the brain, in the synapses, in the second messenger systems, with genetic transcription. All of that happens over months and longer. So day-to-day, hour-to-hour changes in blood levels are completely irrelevant to that mechanism. And for all those reasons, I think it's generally preferable to give most of our drugs once a day, even if they have short half-lives in most cases.
Well, let's talk specifics. How would you dose risperidone, azenapine, Depakote, Geodon, Ziprasidone? Would you give those all at once?
Definitely. I would give Safras once at night. I give risperidone once at night. I give valproate once at night. I gave lithium once at night. Budon, I tend to give BID, but if somebody had any problems with a morning dose, I would just move it all to night.
What about buspirone, Buspar?
Well, buspirone is just a symptomatic anxiolytic drug. It's got a very short half-life. So if you're using it for daytime anxiety symptoms, then I could see giving that twice a day or even three times a day.
And you mentioned lithium there. Are there other advantages to giving lithium once a day besides compliance?
Yes, and thanks for asking that question, because this is a special case where we have a major benefit from giving lithium once a day. Lithium once a day has been shown repeatedly to have less long-term kidney impairment than twice or three times a day. And this makes sense because when you are giving it twice a day or three times a day, you are getting more stable blood levels, which is bad for your kidney. Your kidney consistently is exposed to high levels of lithium. When you give it once a day, you get a brief peak, which is bad for the kidney, but most of the day you have a trough, which is good for the kidney, so that most of the time the kidney is not seeing a level of, say, 0.8, but a level of 0.3 or 0.4. It's almost like taking half as much, and that gives you less kidney impairment. Besides the fact that it has a 24-hour half-life, so there's absolutely no reason to give it more than once a day, it's definitely the beneficial approach for the long-term treatment of preventing kidney.
Thank you, Nasir. Nasir Gami is a professor of psychiatry at Tufts University and a lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard University. He also works part-time as the director of translational medicine and neuroscience at Novartis Institutes for Biomedical Research. His new book is Clinical Psychopharmacology, and he'll be joining us again next month for a conversation on generalized anxiety disorder.
Thanks for joining us. If you like us, you can check us out online and get $30 off your first year subscription. Just use the promo code PODCAST. That's PODCAST in all caps.
The subscription includes full access to all the articles on the website, monthly CME credits, and the print edition delivered to your mailbox.